Welcome to the Angle Podcast. Scario, you nice?
I'm good.
In this weather, you're good?
I'm always good.
The president is doing something to this weather. They're giving us all kinds of weathers this year. Interesting topic we have in store for you today. It's around the South African presidency in the G20. The G20 presidency is about a year, and we are having that seat. Now, the key question to this is what are we going to do with that power? There is a lot of work that needs to be done as far as digital transformation is concerned. There are other policies that we may want to put in effect. But what power do we really have as the president of the G20? And what are we going to do with that power? Here to help us unpack and get to the bottom of this is Dr. Muzukisi Ngqobo. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity to have a conversation with yourselves about the G20 presidency. It's a great year and the right country to be hosting the G20, and we look forward to creating value as chair of the G20 in year 2025. It's a lovely opportunity where you have 19 most significant economies, 19 systemic economies around the table to talk about matters that are important for the world today, in particular on how we coordinate better global economic action among these 19 plus the EU actors.
Well, thanks for joining us. You did mention just now in your intro, you said it's the right country to host it. Maybe just outline what you mean by that. And also, you know, what do you see as South Africa's greatest opportunity in this context?
Well, we are the right country. We are the leading economy on the African continent. We've been a member of the G20 since its inception at the Leaders Summit, at the height of the global economic crisis. And we've always been looked up to as one of the important countries in the world to prefer solutions to very difficult global challenges. As you know, the G20 is a premier organization, is a premier group for coordinating global economic action. And as South Africa, we are enthused to be part of this group at this time when the global economy is going through stress. Just yesterday, we had the announcement of tariff measures. There are other very important themes in the world. Everyone is talking about digitalization, the role that AI can play as a catalyst for growth and inclusive development, the role of digital services in driving new value in the global economy, in creating space for small and medium enterprises, for women, for youth, but also AI to solve some of the most critical challenges from healthcare to education to economic participation of underserved groups in the economy.
Yeah. So, Doctor, if you were to explain this to a younger person, what is the G20? What is the G20 presidency? If you were to explain this to somebody, maybe say in high school.
Well, the G20 presidency is really a mechanism to bring together important economies around the world to stabilize the global economy, to promote dynamism in the global economy, to strengthen cooperation, because the global economy operates as a network of economies of different countries. If it works well for everyone, i.e. Countries can trade, can do business across the border, They can invest, companies can invest, cross-border flows of investments. But also countries can cooperate in overcoming challenges that are common to all, from infrastructure to some of the difficulties experienced by supply chains, to how best to manage digitalization, which in itself is a highly networked economic activity, both within and across countries.
With the limited time that we have, duration is a year, right? With that time, what should we focus on as the chair?
Well, as the chair, because South Africa is the only African country that is a member of the G20, and as the chair, we are placing a great deal of emphasis on Africa, on the African continent. For an example, you currently have a high internet usage in many developed economies. The rate of connectivity or the extent of connectivity is very high, typically in many developed economies. Not so for the African continent. So we still have a divide between the African continent and the developed world. The internet usage on the African continent is very low. There's low coverage of data centers on the continent. The utilization of artificial intelligence on the continent is low. Yet many of the problems that these technologies are designed to create are found or concentrated on the African continent, from education to healthcare, to low participation of young people in the economy, and so forth. So we want to leave a legacy through an initiative that is aimed at casting a spotlight on the African African continent, especially around AI. So that's one of the major outcomes that we see the G20 presidency yielding in 2025.
I mean, a year isn't a very long time. And when looking at nation states and so forth, it's not a very long time to implement policy. I mean, do you consider this as this G20 moment as a symbolic gesture, or is it more of a, can it translate into tangible benefits across AI, data governance, and digital trade? What are your views there?
It certainly can, because remember that every G20 presidency builds on the presidency before. So there's you're building a flywheel from one presidency to another. And you're quite right, many of these things take a while to have a big whip splash. But you've got to start somewhere. So we, as South Africa, we're part of the African continent. We want to play a constructive role in highlighting the importance of the African continent in the global digital economy. Let's walk steps back. A few years ago, Germany's presidency highlighted the importance of Compact for Africa. And there's still a conversation about how to unlock some of the challenges related to a proper compact between the developed world and Africa, between the G20 countries and African economies, around debt, around trade, around financial flows, around development, around inclusivity. So if you take the G20 as a massive building, every country puts a block in the shape of the building, and eventually many of these elements do yield outcomes. They do create distinctive value as part of a larger architecture. So Digitalization is an avenue for inclusion, is an avenue for enhancing economic participation. The African continent has the high proportion of its population as young people. It's the next frontier of growth. It's a continent that has massive opportunities if we can solve some of the challenges that confront the continent. And one of those challenges, of course, lack of digital public infrastructure, digital literacy is low. The utilization rate of some of the digital tools, I mean, just as an example, if you look at many developed economies, the ownership rate of digital tools is, in some instances, 10 to 1. One person has 10 digital tools. On the African continent, I think the utilization, the ownership rate is still less than 2%. Sorry, less than 2 to 1. And that tells you that there is an opportunity to broaden the density of ownership of digital tools, creating a digital public infrastructure and promoting digital literacy on the African continent.
Okay. I mean, if you're looking at, I mean, AI is a big issue at this point. It's certainly dominating the, G20 discussions and what that actually might look like. African countries are typically not seen as shapers of these norms. Do you see an opportunity to change that this year, or how are you guys assessing that sort of transition?
There is certainly an opportunity to change that because we are having a conversation in the context of the G20, drawing the best of insights from other G20 members that are advanced. And I think there is a recognition that the African continent has opportunities to expand digital services, to expand digital public infrastructure, but also to expand some of the commercial elements in AI, such as the data centers. I think African continent share of global centers is roughly 2%. And this can be expanded because we have great endowments, attributes on the continent. We have a land base. We have a sunshine. And some countries have a potential for green hydrogen. So we many countries don't have the benefits of landmass, and they have constraints in expanding, say, the data centers. You also have on the African continent an untapped, potentially large data in the number of the population growth on the African continent, and much of Africa's data is housed outside of the continent, and as Africa's data becomes richer and richer, there could well be opportunities to house this within the continent, and certainly that data could contribute commercially in the use of some of the AI applications.
So just a quick question to slip in there before Stanley has one. And how you think in terms of data centers, and how are you actually thinking about? You just mentioned that most of African data is actually housed off continent. How are you thinking about data sovereignty in your work and in your perspectives?
Data sovereignty is very important, but in the immediate, I think free data flow and safety of data safety, privacy issues, issues to do with critical security of the data are much more important. Data sovereignty in the main is a function of trust, of privacy, of security. Many African countries at present don't have the critical assets to house data centers, even though they do have the attributes of land, land mass. We still have constraints related to energy. The microchips, especially the advanced microchips that are used in training AI, the African continent is not a player there. And many of the companies that are at the frontier, that is, at the cutting edge of AI, are non-domiciled. They are not domiciled in Africa. They are largely from advanced industrial economies in the West, as well as in China in the main. So this presents challenges for Africa's value proposition. It is perhaps something that can be changed in the future.
Yeah. Please help me understand. I'm not sure how to phrase this necessarily, but whenever the G20 is mentioned, there is big talk around opportunity. So much so, you'd think the G20 presidency is an opportunity to explore opportunities. But how real are these opportunities? I mean, Africa is rife with opportunities to create and develop and build. That is very clear. The youth in our country, the youth across the continent are largely digital. They're on digital devices. They're creating and working in digital environments. Yes, save for the rural parts of the continent at large. But to a large extent, I mean, the smartphone penetration is at over 80%. So there's a lot of digital activities. That much is clear. What power do we have to sort of motivate the economy, to get younger people involved in the economy, to reduce things like data costs? And in the back of my head, I'm also thinking, okay, we can try and create policy that can work towards reducing the data costs, but there'll definitely be pushback from the telcos. And you only have a year. What are we doing? Are we just going to go around and find and document opportunities, or can we actually grab those opportunities? And again, lastly, are there countries that were able to identify and explore these opportunities within the duration of their presidency?
Well, this is a great question, a very, very difficult question to answer, because as I indicated earlier, you don't solve challenges in the G20 at one fell swoop. So I think it's very important to recognize and acknowledge the fact that there is value in the conversation itself, about a conversation that is focused on Africa. I alluded earlier to the AI for Africa initiative, which is one of the centerpiece of the G20 conversations under South Africa's presidency. But also you have real problems about digital divide, the fact that the digital infrastructure in many African countries is very thin. Many African countries are, especially rural regions in most African countries, still utilize 2G and 3G, or rely on satellite access. Many African countries don't have energy, electricity connectivity, or stable, affordable connectivity. And also digital literacy is very low. There are lessons that other countries have. For an example, India had as what they call the digital village program, which connects remote communities with Wi-Fi and government e-services. We are thinking about this. If you look at our digital economy master plan, There are several other examples elsewhere, but we need to focus on questions of digital divide, both between Africa and the rest of the world, as well as within Africa, between the rural areas and the urban areas. Because once you build a high density of digital infrastructure, you also enable rural businesses to thrive, to be users of e-commerce platforms, to use these platforms for selling crafts. You could use digital tools for tourism, for agriculture, either to aggregate small-scale farmers on the digital platform for buyers that are remote, to address logistic challenges. But you've got to start somewhere. And I think the G20 provides a space for the sharing of experiences.
All right, I suppose my question really then is, and thanks for giving that background, that really helps. To close the gap within the digital divide, I don't see how that happens without some change in policy. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe we start with the presidency is the start of that process. But what power do we then have beyond there? We started the conversations now, and to try and close that gap for the digital divide, to try and get internet access to the most remote areas in South Africa, to make sure connectivity is throughout, not just in urban areas, to try and build smart cities. This we do not do without buy-in from private sector. This we do not do without big tech. But for that to happen, because they prioritize their bottom line and profits, there has to be a lot of policy change. The conversation starts now, but beyond the presidency, what power do we then have to affect the change?
No, excellent question. Back to your initial point about the costs, the cost of data matters. You would recall that a few years ago, about 2-3 years ago, South Africa had this data inquiry, which uncovered a lot of challenges related to, high data cost by the telcos. The point that you make, the focus, narrow focus on the bottom line, and there are examples there or lessons there that we can share to other African countries. In fact, as a matter of fact, we shared the outcomes of that inquiry at the World Trade Organization to other members. And because these challenges are not unique to South Africa or African continent, you find them in many other developing countries, especially small and vulnerable economies. So beyond the G20, so the AI for Africa initiative, for an example, can be sustained beyond the G20. As a dialogue among African countries, but also as a dialogue between Africa and the G20 members on an ongoing basis. Because it doesn't mean that when the presidency moves away from us, all the things we talked about disappear. We still have an opportunity to contest some of the most important elements. Furthermore, we also... some of the international institutions, including the WTO, the United Nations Trade and Development, UNCTAD, have been doing a lot of work to assess, especially in the case of UNCTAD, what they refer to as e-readiness of developing countries. What are the factors that hobble e-readiness especially in developing countries, especially many, oftentimes these challenges are found on the African continent. There is a connecting thread across. There's a connecting thread across. There are themes that come up across all these countries. Some of these include, the high tariffs in some of the countries on ICT products. So if you reduce ICT products as a country, you make ICT products easily accessible for your consumers, for your citizens. They are cheaper, so to speak. And partly you could argue that apart from income poverty, The high cost of devices is one of the factors that hinder access or ownership of digital tools. I mean, digital tools is it's one of the elements, but very important because on the African continent, including in South Africa and in many rural parts of the country, the primary access instrument that citizens use to connect to the internet is not broadband, it's not fixed broadband. It's your telephone, it's your mobile device. So we have these instruments in our hands. So the question is, how do we unleash them? Data cost, as you indicated, is one of those. But for economy-wide impact, public-private partnership is needed. I don't want to be harsh on corporates. I think some, I mean, if you look at Naspers and, you know, some of the big tech, your Google, your Amazon Web Services, your Microsoft, including your Huawei, they've been very active in talking to universities, engaging with government, and in some instances, autonomously creating products, sort of programs to support township businesses to participate in the digital economy. But once you enrich those conversations and you focus them on how unlock the potential of the ecosystem, the digital ecosystem, you can realize new forms of innovations, not just in the urban areas, but also in the rural areas to close the digital divides between the two.
Could I ask you to expand on that a little bit? I mean, if you're assuming these kind of these initiatives and this infrastructure and policy reform and capacity building is on the way, what would be your message perhaps to innovators on the continent, civic tech builders and digital entrepreneurs, and how can they, if they're watching this process unfold, what would be maybe your advice to them and how they can get involved?
Yeah, I kind of missed the first part of your question. If you don't mind, please.
I'm just saying that, you know, given your previous answer, if we're seeing these reforms coming forward, if we're seeing these developments occur, what would be your general advice towards innovators on the continent and civic tech builders and digital entrepreneurs? What would be your advice to them in terms of seizing the moment and maybe riding this potential wave?
I think we already are seeing some positive developments in parts of the African continent, you know, especially on the tech startup side. I mean, Flutterwave has grown massively, Jumia. You know, you pick up these stories about Africa's unicorns. I'm not a fan of referring to unicorns or using the Silicon Valley language, because there are unique characteristics that you find in Silicon Valley, among Silicon Valley tech startups, that you will never, you know, you will never find in many African contexts. So I think we also need a mindset shift about what a successful tech startup ought to do, what it should look like, focusing more on solving some of the real challenges on the African continent. I mean, some of these startups that become your unicorns in the US especially, have valuations that cannot be explained scientifically. You know, so you are creating illusions for other countries, and it might be best even to look at how many for one startup that succeeds and becomes a unicorn, how many have failed. So on the African continent, I think the tolerance rate for failure is great. But there is a need also for, I mean, if we stick to startups, tech startups, and I know this was not, you know, the main subject of our discussion, you need to create hybrid models for supporting tech startup ecosystem, including government-backed venture, the multilateral development banks on the continent to come to play, the family foundations, private foundations, rather. So you'll have to rely on unorthodox instruments to de-risk the environment for startups. But on civic tech, I mean, we've seen really very interesting examples in Kenya, born on the back of some of the very difficult periods politically, and attempts to use technology to promote civic conversations or conversations about enhancing public participation in policy development processes, or to build communities, not so much for commercial reasons, but to, you know, to build social capital. So there's a lot that can be done on the African continent. There are plenty of examples. Some I covered in my last book. I had a whole chapter on digital innovation, on tech startups. I also have a chapter with a Canadian academic coming up in a Cambridge University Press book, looking at this idea of tech unicorns on the African continent. So I'm pretty passionate about the digital economy ecosystem, but I'm also aware that you need to solve the elementary problems related to digital literacy, digital public infrastructure, to data costs, to affordability of devices, to energy infrastructure challenges, because all of those will help to unlock opportunities. And it's not government alone, it's government and the private sector and other stakeholders working together. In some instances, regarding regulation, using sandbox methodologies.
Just to piggyback off of Scott's question, I think it's very important that digital creators and entrepreneurs out there fully grasp this and understand the opportunities that lie in there. If you consider the example of unicorns, and you look at Nigeria, at your Flutterwaves, and a number of those startups there, I think Nigeria is sitting on 4 unicorns now. Three of them are in fintech. I think one is a marketplace. How did they get there, and what environment enabled that to happen? I don't think that was accidental. And if you look at the founders of the 4 unicorns that came out of Nigeria, most are not Nigerian born. They are, what do you call, what's the political correct word for this? They
migrant were labor.
Yes, they they were born, well, they went to school outside the continent, came back with skill and solved a particular problem. Again, what enabled that in Nigeria for the fintech to happen? So much so that we don't see the same in South Africa, for example, where a M-Pesa would work in Kenya, but it wouldn't necessarily work in South Africa. In Kenya, it worked because there's just one telecoms, Safaricom, I think it is. 80% of the country is on Safaricom, so everyone is using M-Pesa as a result. You come to South Africa, you have 4 big telcos. There's not one fintech solution that can work because literally you have to sit on all 4. Now, the G20 is here. We have financial exclusion. We have the digital divide. There are products we can create to bridge that gap. But how is the G20 presidency setting that table for digital creators to say, here are the opportunities. Yes, we see the opportunities. And here's how we are enabling you as creators to then tackle those opportunities, because I think the opportunities are there, but the problem is, how do we get the products into the market, and what are those barriers? Now that we are the president of the G20, okay, finally we get a seat at the table. Do we get the meal, or are we just sitting there having the conversation?
Yeah, again, difficult question. And it's a big theme, which will require a separate conversation on how do we look at Africa's tech startup ecosystem, why are things that are working elsewhere? Because, you know, we have to remember that, of course, we make reference a lot to America, but America is not the only country that has the tech startup, a thriving startup environment. Even in the US, the characteristics in Boston are very different from what you have in Silicon Valley. The different, it is as if they are different countries in terms of the modes of startup, you know, the, especially the VC engagement with each and the profile of risk, etc., etc. Now, if you you can leave the US. Paris has a growing tech startup environment. China has, I think, two competing. I think in the south and in the east, you have competition within one country. One focuses on robotics and another on foundational technologies and other things. India also has its own. So it can go through many countries. Now, coming back to the continent, one of my observations is that the diaspora, that Nigeria has a very dynamic, highly educated, highly entrepreneurial diaspora community. I know that oftentimes the image of Nigeria that is given, or Nigerians that is given, is a very skewed one. It's not often a true reflection of the Nigerians. And you find that it's Nigerians in the diaspora that are working in the U.S., have learned the art of the trade in the U.S., who come back with both partners, because it's not just their money, but it's networks that they have built, and then they come back and they have local knowledge, deep local knowledge. So you bridge capital with local knowledge, because in Africa, and this is also the case in South Africa, and this is not the only problem. So you have an asymmetry, information asymmetry. You have institutional voids between the talent and the opportunity that is in rural areas or in the township or in the country in general, and the holders of capital. So one way to bridge that gap is for your government, the governments on the continent to, for governments, say governments, to have government-backed venture instruments. You see this in Europe, in some of the countries in Europe. I think Germany has the same. Singapore, I spent some time in Singapore last year. So countries are very conscious of, and you will see this a lot in Europe, on the back of the Draghi report that seeks to promote greater innovation across the European Union to catch up with the US. So you do need de-risking instruments, put simply. And one of the major de-riskers is government, because when government steps onto the bridge, it demonstrates the confidence that governments have in the economy, in the startup economy. There are also other factors. Education level does matter. Digital literacy, because you find that especially with the so-called unicorns in Silicon Valley, many of these are coders or finance wizards. Even the dropouts, by the way, these are highly educated. They benefited from top quality education at the school level. So you've got to massify coding skills, massify digital literacy, beyond a skills revolution. I know the debates about, maybe down the line coding is not going to be important because AI can create a code and all of that. But having a part of your DNA and wiring, the idea of coding, I think opens up a vista of opportunity into designing, thinking differently about a startup. The concept of design is gaining currency in the tech startup community. So I think for Nigeria and some of the and you see this in, I think, partly in Ghana and partly in Kenya. So the diaspora community plays a really important role, as well as, of course, the education levels.
How are you feeling in a general sense? Like, are you feeling positive as to the, if you're writing to South Africa's legacy as the chair of G20, if you're looking forward, how's your feeling around it?
I'm feeling great. I think, I've been just listening to some of the conversations and very positive by and large, despite all that's happening in the world currently. There is a great deal of respect for what South Africa is doing as the chair, as the presidency of the G20. The conversations are really elevating. Hence, I started off the discussion by saying we are the right country at the right time to be president of the G20. So I think we have an opportunity to shape the conversations among global leaders in a way that could really inject dynamism, give the global economy a shot in the arm. And I'm confident that we are going to do it.
The first quarter of our presidency has lapsed. What can we report on, and what can we look forward to in the second quarter?
I think it's great that we've sustained the conversations for a quarter, given the frictions in the world. I think that tells a story about the commitment of every member. All of them, not a single member is not in the room. Every country. That tells you something, that leaders are looking for solutions, and the theme of the G20 is a great one to bring everyone together. Solidarity, equality, and sustainable development.
And what can we look forward to in the second one?
I think in the second, the second quarter, the second half of the year?
Yeah.
The second half of the year, I think that is when you will see conversations really maturing. We'll pass the baton, obviously, to the U.S., and we hope that they will continue to play a constructive role in sustaining conversations to bolster the global economy. Because if the global economy is not performing well, it's not performing well for every country, because the global supply chains are interconnected.
All right. Well, we could keep going down the rabbit hole, but
this has been a very interesting conversation. Yeah, there's lots of actual touch points.
I think we all enjoy the conversation.
Yeah. Well, lastly,
we could have part two down the line.
Hey, I'm telling you. Last one from me. What conversations are you having or planning to have, perhaps around fintech?
I think there are conversations that are happening on fintech. I mean, fintech is one of the many platforms for of the digital economy, and extremely important one, especially given the low levels of inclusion, financial inclusion on the African continent. I'm taking a look at some of the startups that have emerged in the last couple of years, some of the initiatives by South African champions such as NASPES, the UBay, and the experiments via the banking sector. And the non-banking sector, the telecoms, in developing fintech technologies. So I think this is really great for financial inclusion. It's also great for facilitating commerce, especially for small and medium enterprises at low transaction fees, the digital payment systems, but also for consumer-to-consumer transactions or interactions. So I think there's a great future for fintech, but this is part of, this is a conversation that is part of a broader picture about building a rich digital economy.
I think that's a nice point.
Yeah.
All right. Doctor, thanks so much for your time. That was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. You asked very tough questions, I must say, but very good, very good. It makes me think. I think I enjoyed it. I hope we can do it again down the line. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for your time, Doctor.
Thank you.
Great. So thanks.
So all right, cheers. Bye. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been The Angle Podcast, and thank you so much to Dr. Mzu. Please do like, subscribe, and share on all social media platforms. Do have fun in the comment section. And until next time, just
see ya.